From alpine skiing to extreme snowboarding now, the men's halfpipe finals are tonight. And here to talk about that competition is NPR's Tom Goldman. Tom, hi.
Hi, Melissa.
The favorite, Tom, in any halfpipe event would have to be American Shaun White. We know him from that flaming red hair and his unbelievable skills on the board. He is bringing a really wild, complex, dangerous trick with him, the double McTwist 1260. What is that?
Something that I would never try. It's a maneuver, Melissa, borrowed from skateboarding. And White calls it the hardest trick he's ever done, which is saying a lot because he does really hard tricks. Basically, he rotates a total of 1,260 degrees on two different axes, vertical and then horizontal. So essentially, it's 3.5 spins and a double flip in midair, made possible by a taller halfpipe course. 2 years ago, competition officials decided to raise the halfpipe walls from 18 to 22 feet. And this obviously allows for bigger jumps and more time in the air, and allows for White and others to push the envelope and create more moves like this.
You know, Tom, there was a terrible accident leading up to the Olympics of an Olympic hopeful, Kevin Pierce, who was training on the halfpipe in Utah, sustained a brain injury. What's going on with Kevin Pierce?
Yeah, well, you know, he is recovering, which is the good news, you know, considering that he had what doctors, you know, called a severe traumatic brain injury, and he nearly lost his life. This is the dangerous side of things, Melissa, when you push things, when you raise the walls 18 to 22 feet. You know, Pierce went down. It was a horrible accident. Shaun White, who we were just talking about, the king of halfpipe, he had a nasty crash during practice at the X Games. He slammed his face on the lip of the halfpipe while he was trying his new move. His head snapped back. The helmet went flying. He was lucky to walk away with just a huge scrape on his jaw. And there have been other injuries, too. The halfpipe coach for Canada was quoted recently about these and other injuries to top male halfpipe athletes. He said they're dropping like flies.
You know, Tom, I saw the video of that Shaun White accident, and it's terrifying. I mean, is there a backlash? Are you hearing people saying, stop increasing the height of these half-pipe walls? We've got to put some kind of limit here.
Well, yeah, you may be hearing it. We don't hear it here, and you certainly don't hear it from the athletes. I mean, Shaun White, when he was asked about it, you know, he said, we fall, we get back up, we try again.
A lot of these questions, of course, Tom, also being raised because of that deadly accident on the luge track right before the game started where the Georgian athlete was killed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that has put all of this that we're talking about into extreme focus. You know, this Olympic motto, Citius Altius Fortius, Latin for swifter, higher, stronger. That's a phrase that's been glorified. But of course, you know, these accidents and then the tragedy that you speak of has really, you know, brought home this push for faster and bigger. Interestingly, the Wall Street Journal had an article about the course where this accident happened, where the loser died. And basically, its investigation found out that, you know, this course was designed to maximize speed and to make sure that it pays off in the future. The Vancouver Bid Committee agreed to locate the track at Whistler, where the Alpine events are. There was another site recommended, but Whistler was considered more financially viable after the games. You know, the Vancouver organizing official said, was quoted as saying, in order to make this thing financially sustainable, we want it, the track, someplace where people will pay top dollar to go whipping down this thing in both summer and winter. The problem with Whistler, the track could only be located in a very narrow valley, making the track steeper and the speed's more treacherous, the fastest in the world.
The German designer of that track, Tom, is quoted in that article as saying he modeled a top speed on that track of 102 miles per hour.
Frightening. I mean, incredibly frightening. And even for sliders who you know, continually push the envelope on speeds, many of them, tragically, including Nodar Kumaratashvili, the young man who died, reportedly expressed fear to his father before the games. But, you know, his father apparently told him, well, just, you know, try and slow yourself down. And the young man said to his father, what, you're a former loser. Are you crazy? You don't do that.
That's NPR's Tom Goldman at the Olympics in Vancouver. Tom, thank you.
You bet, Melissa.
This is NPR. Whether you're in line at the grocery store or online at a website, tabloid gossip is easier than ever to indulge in. But snacking on celebrity dish is different from devouring an entire book. For our series, My Guilty Pleasure, we invite authors to recommend a book they're embarrassed to admit they read. Well, today, writer Mark Aceto admits to an obsession with the juicy tell-all memoir.
Starting when I was in the second grade, my father would drop me off at the library on Saturday afternoons while he went to his office. It was the 1970s, when children still roamed free, like wolves. In my case, I headed straight for the adult biography section. You see, biographies for children focus on people who discover life-saving drugs and make the world a better place. But adult biographies focus on the dissolute, the people who do life-threatening drugs and die half-naked on the toilet. This is the world I wanted to know about. The pill-popping, bed-hopping lives of Elvis and Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe. My latest favorite in the genre is Gladiator, a true story of roids, rage, and redemption. The title alone made me want to read it. Boy meets drugs, boy loses mind, boy finds peace. It's almost mythological. Indeed, I hadn't even heard of the author, Dan Clark, who went by the name Nitro on the TV game show American Gladiators. Clark's story is as compelling as it is pathetic and uplifting. A tale of someone so desperate to make it big, he literally makes himself big. Clark's book does what the best stories do, sweeps us away into another world, one in which he almost gets shot trying to smuggle muscle-building drugs over the border from Mexico. While I wasn't like most second-grade boys, I am like most guys, in that I'd love to have arms the size of ham hocks, to have a body that looks like a bad allergic reaction. But the sad irony of steroids is that two of the side effects are the shrinking of some crucial male anatomy and the development of what Clark calls chesticles, both of which he writes about in graphic, wince-inducing detail. So I chose to experience his misguided life vicariously without adding his mistakes to my own. But why was I so ashamed to read Clark's book that I wouldn't even buy it, then avoided the librarian by using the self-serve? For the same reason, few of us like to admit how much we enjoy the reality TV revolution that American Gladiators helped spawn. A book is an accessory, and there's something inherently unattractive about our appetite for celebrity dish. And I worry there's something unhealthy in our wanting to know how people with more ambition than talent find success, than taking pleasure in their failures. Then again, what would a guilty pleasure be without an overdose of guilt?
Mark Aceto admits to taking chocolate protein powder before he lifts weights in Portland, Oregon. You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The peaceful countries of Scandinavia are producing quantities of murder and mayhem these days in the form of best-selling mystery novels. Perhaps it's those long, dark winters. Leading the invasion of Nordic noir is Sweden's Henning Mankell. He's well-known as the creator of the gruff and rumple detective Kurt Wallander, now the subject of a PBS series. And while Mankell's latest book, The Man from Beijing, has a different hero, readers will still be hooked by the saga and the opening scene. A photographer is traveling through rural Sweden in winter. He arrives in a village he plans to photograph, but something about the cluster of small houses seems wrong.
The chimneys, they were cold. There was no sign of smoke. His gaze moved slowly from house to house. Somebody's cleared the snow already, he thought. But not lit a single fire.
That's Henning Mankell reading from the beginning of The Man from Beijing.
He remembered a letter he'd received from the man who had told him about the village. He had referred to the chimneys and how the houses seemed, in a childish sort of way, to be sending smoke signals to one another. But now, not a sign of smoke.
And from there it gets really scary. Because when the photographer goes to try to find somebody in the village, knocks on doors, nobody answers, finally he looks in a window, and almost everyone in the whole village is dead.
Yes, that's the starting point of this story, yes.
Has anything like that ever happened in Sweden, a mass murder of that kind?
As far as I know, never. But I do write fiction, and the definition of fiction is very simple. It is that what I write is something that could have happened, but not necessarily has happened.
Many of your books have been thrillers of one kind or another, or police procedurals. This book represents a change in that your detective, Kurt Wallander, is not in it, and you've switched to a cast of characters that are almost all women. Not only the protagonist who solves the problem, but other characters as well. There are a whole lot of women in this book.
Yes. I grew up, my father was a judge. This time when I wrote The Man from Beijing, I decided to use my knowledge about, well, the knowledge of a judge, but to distance myself from my father, I chose to make a female judge.
Is it different to write about women?
Well, I'm always very interested in reading what women write about men. So I guess that women are as interested to see what men are writing about women. Since we are living in a world where women are almost always better than men on doing everything, then I think it's very important to find out why is it so? Why do women do things better than men? I really mean now what I'm saying. Because women doesn't start war, for example. And so I'm always very interested to see the perspective of women, how they look upon the world.
The story is a complicated story, and it's what you switch scenes there from Sweden to briefly in the United States. Africa plays a role, but mostly China. Where does that come from?
As you know, I live part-time of my life in Africa since almost 30 years. I live in Mozambique. And about 10 years ago, the Chinese government had offered the government of Mozambique to build a new building for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And fine, that's good. And so the Chinese started to build this building. But then suddenly there were rumors that the Chinese foreman did treat the African workers badly. And there were even rumors that the Chinese foreman started to beat the African workers. And at that time I asked myself, hey, what is happening here? And at that time I decided I would like to write about this.
Part of your plot in writing about the Chinese coming to Africa is you are writing about the idea of dominion, of domination. China absorbing Africa's natural resources and taking them away. Do you actually see any of that kind of thing happening? I mean, you're living in Africa. You have a view of it that we don't have.
Yeah, I see a good presence of the Chinese. I see how they offer to, willingly to help with building infrastructures. But the other side of the coin is some tendencies of a sort of colonial idea. And one of the worst cases, this is really happening, and this goes not only for China, it's also other countries in Asia that is now buying up agricultural land in Africa where there's supposed to be produced food that is being brought back to China while the hungry Africans are standing outside. So I would say that I'm building my novel on facts and on real worries. I really think it's very good that China takes an important role and position in the world. But we have to have a critical view upon that, as we have to have for the Russians and even for the Americans, in a way.
So what do you think is coming next? Are you still thinking in these terms of China and Africa, or the judicial system? Are you going back to Wallander?
No, actually, I think that I am going in another direction now. As you know, it's very difficult. You shouldn't talk about what you are writing for the time being. But next novel, it's going to be something very, very, very different.
No hint?
The leading lady will once again be a lady, and it's going to be a Swedish woman that goes 100 years ago. This is built upon a real story that goes to Africa and all of a sudden finds herself as an owner of a brothel. But more than that, I cannot say.
Okay.
It's a good start of a story, don't you think?
I would say it's a very good start of a story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Henning Mankell is the author of The Man from Beijing. He also writes the popular Kurt Wallander series. And he says, be on the lookout for another Wallander book. It is called The Troubled Man. It arrives in the States in 2011. And if you want more of the chilling beginning of The Man from Beijing, read it at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer, in for Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The federal government is on track to run up the largest deficit in history this fiscal year, according to the latest numbers from the Treasury Department. President Obama plans to sign an executive order today creating an independent commission to come up with solutions to the problem. But he's not likely to get much help from Republicans, who say the commission is just political cover for raising taxes. NPR's Andrea Seabrook has more.
Home foreclosures, economic stimulus, even health care, those now seem like last year's issues. And the Obama administration is pivoting away from them toward the new biggies, jobs and the debt.
Sometimes, particularly in tough times like these, you have to make hard choices about where to spend and where to save. That's what being responsible means. It's a bedrock value of our country. And that ought to be a value that our government lives up to as well.
President Obama's radio address last weekend, in it he foreshadowed today's news.
I've proposed a bipartisan fiscal commission to provide recommendations for long-term deficit reduction. Because in the end, solving our fiscal challenge, so many years in the making, will take both parties coming together, putting politics aside, and making some hard choices about what we need to spend and what we don't. It will not happen any other way.
Today, the president plans to sign an executive order creating the commission and will announce its co-chairs, Democrat Erskine Bowles, the White House chief of staff under President Bill Clinton, and Alan Simpson, the former Senate Republican whip. Sounds workable, right? Well, remember, Mr. Obama tried to get Congress to create this commission itself, but it failed in the Senate, in part because seven Republicans who'd originally sponsored the idea voted against it. Why? They smelled something funny in the proposal, the possibility of tax increases, and they want nothing to do with that. Now, creating the commission by executive order doesn't solve the problem of how to get fiscal conservatives to join the effort. Outside Washington yesterday, a group of conservative luminaries met on the grounds of Mount Vernon, the home of President George Washington. There they held a ceremony led by Ed Meese, Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan.
And that is why we are here, to recommit ourselves to the ideals and principles that have made America a just, prosperous, and free nation like no other nation in the world.
Conservatives were there to sign what they dubbed the Mount Vernon Statement, a pledge to return to what conservatives believe are the fundamental underpinnings of American society, all strictly laid out in the Constitution.
The Mount Vernon Statement we are about to sign honors, quote, the central place of individual liberty in American politics and life, and calls for the application of the principle of limited government to every proposal of our elected representatives.
One of the keys to America's success, conservatives say, is keeping the government small, spend less. So you might think they'd be interested in the commission to rein in the debt.
It's goofy. It's all showmanship.
Brent Bozell is president of the Media Research Center, a conservative media watchdog.
It's all showmanship on their part. To have this commission, if you want to reduce the debt, reduce the debt. Why have a commission? Why have this silliness?
Conservatives here are also worried that the commission will recommend higher taxes, when what they want is to dramatically cut government spending, and they're not terribly interested in compromising on anything right now. But David Keene of the American Conservative Union says not participating in the commission could be risky.
The political risk is, will people outside say, well, gee, you know, you're not a part of it, so aren't you concerned? But I think that given the structure of what they're doing, it's entirely appropriate not to be involved.
Still, Keene says, Republicans will have to show that they too have ideas for how to deal with the deficits and the debt if they want to go from a loud minority to a majority that governs responsibly. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Northern Virginia.
In Vancouver, for the high-energy freestyle and snowboard events, there's also a high-energy soundtrack. A bunch of the skiers and boarders pick the music they want to play during their runs, and it's up to Mike Nakagawa, also known as DJ Nakaji, to put that soundtrack together. So tonight at the men's halfpipe, what'll we hear when snowboarding superstar Shaun White kicks off?
He likes AC/DC, Back in Black. Look to hear that. He also likes Led Zeppelin. He's also picked A Whole Lot of Love, Kashmir, and Paradise City by Guns N' Roses.
Okay. And what else should we be listening for tonight with the other snowboarders?
Matthew Kreppel from France. If he makes it, he's going to want some Michael Jackson, Beat It, or Neil Young, Rockin' in the Free World. James Hamilton from New Zealand is going to want Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil or Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard. And apparently he's an AC/DC fan as well, and his theme song is Shook Me All Night Long.
Now, the women's halfpipe event will be tomorrow night. Give us some sense of what's in store for the women tomorrow in music.
Well, I'm actually a personal friend of Gretchen Bleiler.
Uh-huh.
She told me she wants Disco Inferno and AO Technology as well by 50 Cent.
What about some of the other women?
We just got word from Hannah Teeter. She wants I Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas. And The Big Pink by the Dominoes. And actually, Kelly Clark, she's a very religious girl, and she always provides us with her own Christian rock CDs.
What about the women competing from other countries?
Let me see. Let me take a look here. Rebecca Sinclair from New Zealand, she wants L.E.S. Artiste by Santi Gold, and I Feel It All by Feist, How Bizarre by OMC, and Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Huh.
Yeah.
Would you ever approach an athlete and say, you know what, I've got a great song for you, you're going to love this?
Not really, because I guess I kind of get the opportunity to pick their song anyway if they don't have a song.
Yeah.
And luckily my producers and my directors trust me enough to be able to say, well, we trust your judgment. You can play whatever you want for them.
Would you be trying to send a subliminal message sometimes through the music?
Yeah, sometimes. I like to bring up a little bit of the tension that's involved with events like this, the excitement. If somebody falls or has a crash, we try to play something that'll kind of bring their spirits back up.
Like what?
Something high energy like that everybody knows, like Metallica, Enter Sandman, or my favorite song, just to get the whole crowd into it, is either Bro Him by Pennywise or TNT by AC/DC, because they're songs that, you know, a lot of the crowd knows, and literally the whole crowd will be singing along. I played actually TNT the other night at the Moguls contest, and everybody was screaming, "Oi, oi, oi," just like the song does, and it was pretty amazing seeing 5,000 people do that.
Is this your first Olympics?
It's my first Olympics. It's always been a dream of mine. Actually, since my hockey and ski and snowboard dreams are over, why not show up as a DJ?
Well, Mike, DJ Nakaji, thanks very much. Have fun.
Thank you very much. Have a good one.
Mike Nakagawa is music director for the Cypress Mountain venue at the Vancouver Olympics. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.